hppodcraft.com.
It was on a heavily laden troop ship, westward heading. Hours before, the sun had gone down toward China, trailing ebon night behind her. For a full week, since dropping the California coast behind us, there had been nothing in all the wild waste of waters for us to see, save ourselves. No ship's funnels broke the lowering horizon. No sign of land, for our skipper had chosen a passage lying somewhere in between the usual steamer lanes. The nearest land, save that which stretched in eternal darkness some 3 miles below us, was more than 1,000 miles beyond the southern horizon. We were just a single ship, burdened with a precious freight of souls, upon an ocean that seemed endless. The first day out had been squally, and everyone had been sick, save those of us who had gone down to the sea in ships before. But with the dawning of the second morning, the sea had calmed down, and our vessel rode through the blue, toward the horizon bowl which ever crept before us, in the golden wake of the setting sun. The voyage, if the old salts spoke truly, would be uneventful. But with that strange premonitory feeling which comes to all of us at times, I did not believe them.
That was the opening of The Bells of Oceana by Arthur J. Burks, a story from Weird Tales that was praised by the author H.P. Lovecraft. And hey, that's why we're going to talk about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com and Patreon. Who was that reader?
You know him. You love him. That reader was Wyatt S. Gray.
Woo!
We're always happy to have Wyatt on the show.
Oh, so good.
He's a comedian and voice actor out here in Los Angeles, aside from just being a good guy. He has just narrated another collection of contemporary weird and horror fiction that is now on Audible. The collection is called Postcards from the Void by the publishers Darkwater Syndicate. They were also behind Shadows and Teeth, which was another excellent collection that Wyatt read for Audible. You can check those out now. We'll link out in the show notes to the collection. Again, it's called Postcards from the Void. That's the new one. Good horror and weird fiction. And you can always catch up with Wyatt, see what he's up to at his site, wyattcomedy.com.
Yeah, do that.
So, The Bells of Oceana. I'll have to admit, from the title of the story, I was a little worried. I don't know, it's sounded pretentious, or yeah, maybe the story would be overwritten. I wasn't sure. I don't know if it's exactly a weird tale. It's kind of a monster story. I don't know. Maybe it is.
Yeah,
we can talk about
weird.
That.
Weird. I think it's weird. Yeah, well, let's talk about it.
Well, it definitely has some mythological underpinnings to it, which I think is pretty cool. But first, let's get the quick and dirty bio on this author. Emphasis on the dirty.
Arthur J. Burks was born in 1898 in Washington State. He served in the Marine Corps during World War I and started writing in 1920. He was stationed in the Dominican Republic, and there he heard voodoo tales, which inspired him to write. In 1924, he sold stories to Weird Tales and resigned from the Marine Corps in 1927 to pursue full-time writing. He was known as the Million Word a Year Man for his voluminous output. He wrote around, get this, 800 stories for the pulps.
Wow.
800.
That's crazy.
Stories. He kind of burned out a little bit in the late 30s and returned to active duty in World War II. And after that war, he moved to Paradise, Pennsylvania, and continued to write until his death in 1974.
Yeah, which is when I was born.
Oh my God.
So according
so
to the
him
rules
reincarnated.
Of the show, that's right. That means his spirit lives in me.
Wow.
So get ready for my 800 books. Or stories, or what have you. Actually, I wish that that were true, because I'm having problems. I've been writing very little the last couple of years, and this year I've been trying to get back into the game. I actually want to do some original fiction for the show. Yeah. I've been tinkering with, amongst other things, but it's slow going. I find that you can get rusty if you let it go for too long. So I really got to get in touch with my inner Arthur J. Burks.
Grab hold of it and put his nose to the paper.
That's right. Twist it out of there and put his nose to the paper, as the old saying goes. One thing that I did read about him in his bio, he was well known for being able to take any household object that someone would suggest to him on a dare and instantly generate a plot based around it.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how he got through 800. They're all about pencils and, you know. I mean, he's like the MacGyver of fiction. I wonder if his publishers ever started to see the trend there and got sick of it. Like, look, we know you're quick with the ideas. We like your output, but we don't want another haunted nail clipper story. We're still trying to make sense of the demon spatula. You know, broaden your horizons a little bit. Get out of the house with it.
3 haunted nail clipper stories is enough. Okay? 4, you're just pushing it. So this story is from the December 1927 issue of Weird Tales.
Great. Well, let's get into it.
Woo! The story begins on a troop ship in the Pacific Ocean. They are out in the middle of nowhere. The narrator is the commanding officer on this journey.
I think that opening paragraph sets the mood so well. That there had been nothing in all the wild waste of waters for us to see save ourselves. Fantastic alliteration in that sentence. Yeah. The nearest land, save that which stretched in eternal darkness some 3 miles below us, was more than 1,000 miles beyond the southern horizon. And the idea of being that separate from humanity, it's only this vessel and the souls aboard it. You can't see buildings, land, other ships, anything. It's such an eerie setting. It says our skipper had chosen a passage lying somewhere in between the usual steamer lanes. So they're also kind of an uncharted territory, presumably just taking a shortcut. Mm-hmm. But because they're outside of the shipping lanes, yeah, not even any other ships to see, not lights in the distance, nothing. I think it's kind of cool that in this story and Amundsen's Tent from last week, even though that one was an Antarctic story, this is a nautical story. Both of them have the blueprints for many of the outer space stories that were to come.
Yeah.
You know, Amundsen's Tent was finding the derelict that contained some horror, like Alien or like The Thing. And this, out alone in uncharted territory, what could be out here with us, you know, that's a million space stories. So both of them contain that element of exploration. I think that's kind of shaping up into a theme for this month.
He says that right away he sensed that there was something bad that was coming down the road and he felt uneasy.
And of course, and everybody who isn't used to sea travel, most of the troops on this ship probably, they've been sick because they hit us some squalls right away. So that can't be helping with the feeling of uneasiness when everybody's throwing up around you.
So he feels that someone or something is watching him.
It says, to add to my feeling of unease, as though it had been all planned out by some invisible something or somebody, the officer who should have had the watch that night fell suddenly ill, and I was called upon to take his place. I knew as I donned my belt, holster, and pistol that I obeyed the will of some invisible prompter, a prompter without a name. I always like when a story has, you know, I shouldn't have even been there. You know, it's element of any story. You know, you realize that if it weren't for this one chance, all of this stuff wouldn't have even happened to me.
That night, 7 sentries were on duty at different parts of the ship. He did his inspections. Then he went to bed, which is just before midnight. He retired to his cabin, in which there is a small porthole. It's not big enough for a person to get through it, but he feels like he's got this impression that somebody's been in his room, even though it's locked. And nobody could have got in. He has the only key. So he feels kind of compelled to look out the porthole, like thinking maybe somebody actually could squeeze through there and creeped out. But then he's like, there's nothing out there. They would just fall into the water. There's nothing to grab onto. There's nothing like
but it's he still
totally.
But there was a cool part. He still feels like maybe somebody's there just holding onto the edge of it and dangling off the side of the ship. Even that's how strong this feeling is that somebody's been in there.
But it's so improbable. Like it's almost impossible that this happened. And yet he is so wigged out by it that he has to go and look. And when he does, there's nothing there, obviously. Feeling satisfied, he begins to take his clothes off for bed.
Go
and
on.
Just then, he sees something out of the porthole.
I stood erect to turn out the lights and paused in the very act. A cry of terror smothered in my throat by a sheer act of will. For the most fleeting of seconds, I had seen a dead white face outside the glass which covered the porthole. It was the face of a person who had drowned, I told myself wildly, and the dripping hair wore a coronet of fluttering seaweed. The eyes of this strange outsider stared straight into mine, devoid of expression, totally unwinking, and the lips, which seemed blue as though with icy cold long endured, smiled a thin and ironic smile.
Creepy.
Yeah.
The face slips away as the lieutenant quickly unscrews the panel of the porthole. But when he looks out, of course, nothing's there again.
And there was some business like this in Lovecraft's story, The Temple.
Yes.
Where the man had seen a drowned person swimming away. But that was published in 1925, actually written in 1920, so... Yeah. Lovecraft wasn't lifting anything from this story.
No.
Might have gone the other way. It's hard to tell.
He's about to close the porthole when he hears something. He hears bells. Like the tiny bells which the bellwether wears to signal the ewes and the lambs was the tinkling of the bells. Like those bells, yet not like them, totally out of place in mid-ocean. And I felt a strange prickling of the scalp as I listened. So he closes the window and he gives out a little scream. Because, you know, it's freaking him out.
Yeah.
There in his room stands the sergeant of the guard, who looks pale and freaked out. And, you know, he's like, Wait, did he? Is he freaking out because I'm freaking out? But he says no, he just did the rounds and one of the sentries is missing. He thinks there could be many reasons this guy's missing. Maybe he snuck off for a smoke. Maybe he was doing his rounds and the sergeant just missed him. You know, like they were walking the same direction and you just didn't see him. But the man in question is an old timer. He's tested. He's done this a long time. So he really wouldn't have done any of those things unless something was really amiss.
It says, I knew he held as many decorations for bravery as any other officer or man in the Marine Corps. There was something terrible, something, if you will, uncanny behind this disappearance of the sentry. There's no way that any of these simple things could explain it.
Right. The Sarge also confesses that he thinks he heard the sound of little bells and that he felt that someone was standing behind him.
Yikes.
So the Sarge says that he went and found wet footprints on the floor, and these footprints look like bare human feet. And by judging the shape, the owner of the footprints was carrying something very heavy. Mm. And that to me sounds like some Sherlock Holmes level of detail analysis there.
Yeah, I bought it, but I was thinking, aren't they out in, there's these large waves, so spray's coming aboard. And I think at this point, there's a storm going on as well. Yeah. So how could you make out wet footprints on the deck? It must have been a dry spot and the discoloration showed that they were bare feet. But you know what? I thought the author is a Marine and has been on these troop ships.
Yeah.
Not saying that this exact thing has happened to him, but I'm going to take him at his word in terms of what you can or can't see on the deck.
Me too. So the narrator needs to hear what the Sarge is suggesting. Look, what do you think happened? Even though he knows what he thinks happened, he wants to hear the Sarge say it. And he says, I think someone took the guard over the side.
Yeah, that's the sergeant's conclusion. Someone with no shoes, maybe some little cat bells around their neck. is out there grabbing sentries.
I think probably an anklet is what I was
maybe
thinking.
It's an anklet, yeah.
They rush out to the spot where the sentry is suspected of falling and look over. The Sarge groans as the narrator looks out into the tumultuous sea and sees two glowing green eyes, only briefly before the waves obscure them.
I didn't expect that, actually. That was pretty scary. I mean, that's not a fish looking up at them.
They find the sentry nearby, and he is lying on the ground, nude and dead. But mostly nude.
Yes, that was crazy. They find him where he should have been when the sergeant made his rounds, but now he's been drowned and he's nude.
The body is wet, chalk white with blue lips.
As coldly blue as though the corpse had been dragged for hours on a line in the wake of the ship. So I guess he got put through the ringer out there in the water, and then whatever this was dropped him off again on deck, I guess?
Yeah.
Which is strange behavior from a monster. I don't know. That makes it extra creepy. I'm putting him back now. Here you go.
Well, what the hell do you think is going on here when you were reading the story? What were your impressions or predictions?
I did not have any at this point. I was confused that the body was back up on deck, but I presumed that the dead sentry was the face that he had seen in the porthole earlier. But when you described that face looking into the porthole of the drowned man, he was smiling.
Yeah.
This ironic smile. Well, what's that about? It seems pretty horrible to be dragged over the side, but for whatever reason, this was pleasurable in some way. I don't know. And I also just kept thinking of the temple, but I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah, I was thinking it was the captain's mutant grandson from the future.
Yeah. That didn't cross my mind, but it's pretty logical based on
way it plays out, it seems like that, you know, I was on the wrong track with it, but they were laying the groundwork for in that direction, and I think they pull a switcheroo to kind of, you know, subvert expectations.
I can see why you would think that.
Anyway, the narrator and the Sarge are scared out of their wits. When the narrator moves, it causes the Sarge to jump and scream, and then they move to the back of the ship. The narrator thinks of the story of Die Lorelei, a poem by a German poet, Heinrich Heine. Basically, it's about sirens, beautiful women singing sailors to their doom.
I think Die Lorelei is actually a real thing, the Lorelei. It's a rock feature in the Rhine. Well, I did not look this up, so I'm just saying off the top of my head. But the idea is that they would sing to attract sailors to crash into this thing.
Yeah.
So that's, it's about sirens, but I think that's what the Lorelei is.
So he also thinks about this picture from an old book of legends.
A picture of a hideous monster of unbelievable proportions who would come up from behind the ocean's horizon, blotting out the sunlight, long arms extended into the picture's foreground, the right hand holding aloft a medieval sailing vessel which had been lifted bodily from the ocean. A fantastic picture, I knew now, drawn to prove the existence of terrible monsters beyond the horizon to which, as yet, no caravel or galleon had dared travel. I wondered, as I strode aft, why this old picture should return to my mind at this time. And fear was at my throat again as I walked.
Of course, I thought of Cthulhu when I heard that description.
Well, yeah.
But the story, again, was written after Lovecraft wrote his.
And sea serpent or sea monster legends have been around as long as people have been getting in boats of any kind.
Of course, of course.
And frequently you'll see those giant monsters even on those old nautical maps. You know, there's just a sea serpent out there. Like, that's where the sea serpent is, so be careful.
Yeah, here there be dragons.
Yeah.
The narrator then hears someone up ahead say, "I'm coming, oh, my beloved." Another of the sentries has thrown his gun to the side and is starting to go over the rail. The sound of the tinkling bells can be heard yet again, and a shadow thing peels off the side of the boat and hovers over the sentry.
It says, "Just for a second, as he strode toward the starboard rail, I could see his face, and the face was transfigured, as though the man gazed into the very soul of the perfect sweetheart somewhere beyond the rail." Although that should have been the title of the story, The Perfect Sweetheart. It's capitalized, too, so that must have been a phrase that was going around at the time.
Oh, perfect. That was your old nickname, Pfeiffer.
It was for a while, yeah, but I didn't know that it was had any connotations beyond the fact that I was a perfect sweetheart.
Just then, the boat goes up high on a wave and then comes crashing down, water splashing over the side, and the sentry's just gone. Then they hear a cry from the water. There came a single long-drawn cry, and it was not a cry of terror, not a cry of pain, but a scream of ecstasy.
What do you think that sounded like?
Oh!
Ooh, this like must that. Be paradise. It's funny, but I mean, it's so incongruous with what's going on that it would be terrifying. I mean, it would make sense.
Oh, yeah.
And they know it wasn't the wave that snatched him over the edge. You know, the narrator says he only had to seize the rail to save himself. So there's no reason that he went overboard. And I liked this a lot. "Did you see the shadow, Lieutenant?" the sergeant replied. "I did not answer. He knew I had seen it."
Yeah.
I really like that interaction because it's true. When you're with somebody and you both see some crazy stuff, you don't always need to talk it over. You can kind of tell from each other's expressions, yeah, you saw that too, didn't you? Yeah, I did.
So again, they hear those bells. Looking out over the sea at the aft of the boat, they see this huge area of seaweed. An undulating mass of odorless seaweed, acres and acres of it there were, rising and falling sluggishly, but keeping pace with the troop ship through the night and the storm.
Here I was thinking, okay, so this is going to be some kind of William Hope Hodgson thing, right? Instead of sentient mold, it's some kind of sentient seaweed. And it's crazy. It's following them.
So the bells ring again, and the seaweed comes to life, writhing around like a huge mass of serpents. They start to pull apart and open up to some black water, and then there are two forms in the water. One is that of the dead sentry, and the other is this woman who holds him in her arms.
It says, I hesitate to give the creature a name. A woman I scarcely know, yet I do know. In the instant I looked into her eyes, I understood the ecstasy I had read in the face of the sentry.
Her breasts nude and unashamed were the breast of a buxom woman, her lips as red as full-blown roses, her hair as black as the wings of a crow, a mantle of loveliness about her wondrous body, whipping this way and that in the storm. Hmm. So the bells tinkle again, and the narrator, he avoids her eyes because he's feeling that she is unnatural.
You think? I mean, the description makes her out to be very beautiful, but I mean, nobody is beautiful enough that you're going to forget all about the seaweed and the dead people, you know. Clearly, she's a siren or kind of a mermaid, and we know from all of those stories that these types of creatures, they cast a spell on you. Mm-hmm. They lure sailors to their doom. That's what I meant earlier about the story being mythological, because,
right.
You know, I think obviously of Odysseus and his crew famously confronted the sirens. They all filled their ears with wax, but he had himself tied up to the mast so he could hear the songs.
The seaweed comes up the starboard side of the ship, all over the railing and onto the deck, making a man-like shape. And then out of the seaweed, the second sentry emerged, nude.
So this creature is dropping off the second body. Kind of unique, giving back the dead. And the narrator thinks, you know, there might be a reason that ships don't come this way ordinarily. Now that I'm looking at what's happening, huh? It says, nauseated by the return of the dead sentry, nude as the first had been, I closed my eyes for a moment, and when I opened them again, there was no seaweed, no monstrous shape upon the promenade. But even from where I stood, I could see the wet footprints and wondered whom next the creature of the deep would claim from aboard our ill-fated vessel.
The lieutenant draws his pistol, believing that this thing to be alive and mortal and thus able to be killed. Don't know why he thinks that, because it could be anything. It could be a ghost. It could be a sea monster. It could be the ghost of a sea monster. Who knows? So he turns as he feels something is near.
But in the very act of whirling, I stop short. For between me and the stern of the vessel, smiling dreamily, water rippling over her nude and glorious body to splash upon the deck, stood the creature who had come up from the depths in the wake of the ship, bearing the dead man in her arms. My arm fell to my side, my weapon clattered to the deck. and as I move forward once more, slowly, a step at a time as the sentry had done, the wondrous creature held out her dripping arms, and my eyes drank in all the glorious wonder of her, from head to... But she had no feet. Where the feet should have been, and the legs, there were neither legs nor feet, but a scaly column, wet and dripping, like a serpent with a woman's body. I screamed in terror and unbelief, but it was too late, and her arms were about me, preventing all escape. But with the touch of those arms, I did not wish to struggle. I knew what had happened to the two sentries, knew the same was the prospect for me. Yet, at the moment, there seemed nothing in all the world more worthwhile than to slip over the side into the depths with the arms of this wondrous creature about me.
So wait a minute. So it's like a mermaid, one of those evil mermaids, but a little more serpentine. However, what was the deal with the footprints earlier then?
Yeah, if she doesn't have feet, so how could she be making footprints? Good question. I don't know. The Sarge calls to him, horrified, but the narrator, he doesn't care. It's warm in the arms of this creature, and he's digging it. She carries him over the rail, but he, again, still doesn't care. It's bliss.
Ooh, it's so much bliss! Ah!
He finds himself in the water, unable to breathe. Holding his breath, he swims up, he thinks. He's confused of which way is up and which way is down. He says, two lips pressed firmly against my own, and those lips saved my life and my reason. For they were the cold lips of a corpse with neither love nor challenge in them. So, is that one of the dead sailors that kissed him?
No, I don't think so.
I'm confused.
I think this is just a turning point for him when the spell breaks.
Oh, I see. So it's her. She's not warm anymore. The spell breaks and she's like a cold, wet thing.
Yeah, it's disgusting because it's the cold lips of a corpse with neither love nor challenge in them. So it's just sort of this empty thing. And that's when he's like, I gotta get out of here.
He reaches out and he gets the line that measures the knots traveled from the ship. And that's all he remembers. The next thing he knows, he wakes up in his bed, and he gets out of bed and he asks the sergeant. He's like, "Well, you know, what's going on?" And the sergeant looks at him like he's acting crazy. And the narrator says, "Are we out of the seaweed?" And the sergeant is like, "Seaweed? Is the lieutenant making sport of me? We're 2,000 miles from any land save the ocean bottom, and there ain't any seaweed anywhere. I don't understand you." So the narrator then asks him about the missing sentries, and the sergeant again says, "I checked on them before midnight. Everything was fine. He doesn't know anything about the bells. So all that interaction that he had with them before, he doesn't remember or it didn't happen. It was a dream. He's not sure."
Yeah, I guess so.
The narrator decides to tell the Sarge, you know what, go check the sentries and make sure they're all accounted for. 10 minutes later, he comes back and we find out the two guards are actually missing.
This is the same sergeant that was with him when it happened. Because for a moment, I thought, okay, this is all going to be a dream or a hallucination. But since the sentries are missing, that's clearly not the case.
No.
The narrator's confused, and so am I.
"But this I know. There are strange things and sounds in the sea near the 180th meridian, 1,000 miles north of Honolulu. And this is the strangest incident in my night of terror. The clothing which I donned next morning was entirely dry, but my hair was stiff with salt water, and there was a tang of seaweed in my room when I awoke. I looked, too, at the glass which covered the porthole beside my bed. Outside that glass were the smudged prints of thin lips, the blur above them which told of a face pressed against the glass from outside, as though somebody or something had tried to peer in between nightfall and morning. And the bells? I can still hear them, in memory. When sometimes I waken at sea after midnight, and the rolling and the plunging of the ship tell me that a storm is making."
And that's the end of the story. Clearly he's scarred by this experience, but that confuses me that the sergeant doesn't remember any of it. So it happened, but it didn't happen.
Yeah. And to me, that's the element of the weird. Like, we don't really understand what exactly happened, where there's things that he remembers. Like, those guys are missing, those sentries, and he experienced that, but then the sergeant wasn't really there when he experienced it, or maybe somehow psychically he got this information, or but his hair had seawater in it, but his clothes were dry, so he actually wasn't in there. So it doesn't make sense.
I mean, maybe it's like the, you know, when the siren calls out to you, it's an entirely hallucinatory experience that's private only to you. So all of this kind of did happen in his mind, but it was because this monster was drawing him out.
Yeah.
That said, I don't know how he survived, and I certainly don't know how you're going to sea after that happens either.
Jeez, yeah.
You know, I'd retire from anything that put me on a ship.
Well, but really, would you? Because I think you'd learn from that experience, and you'd be like, you know what, I'm a better sailor now because I know about these things, and I could deal with them.
How do you deal with them?
By realizing their lips are cold and swimming away.
Yeah, I just feel like, you know, that thing put me under a spell and I was helpless against it. And there's no amount of preparation I could do, especially given that he's not even sure the reality of everything that happened. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe you would actually start chasing it. You'd be like, man, that was the best erotic feeling I've ever had.
It could be.
Get me
that
on
could
a
be
ship
a whole
again.
Other. Yeah, yeah, I want to get back out there to the sirens. That was some sweet stuff. Even though it would have killed me, that's a hell of a way to go.
Doesn't matter. That's right.
You know, there's a lot of stories about mermaids and sirens, and
yeah,
a lot of them being traps, the feminine traps, I guess, because mm-hmm. men would go to sea without women, and that was something that they're desperately looking for, that female contact.
Right. You know, we actually even talked about it on that show, one of those shows we did with Patton, where he talked about the siren song of drugs.
Oh, right.
Because yeah. It represents anything that calls to you and tells you that it's going to be great, but then ultimately will destroy you, you know.
Mm.
It's the lure of something that's attractive to you, but you have to be able to resist it. The fact that it always happens out at sea, I'm not really sure what the deal is with that, other than it's just vast, uncharted territory.
To me, the sea is just really surreal in general, because once you get out a few miles, you don't know where you are. Everything looks the same. It's just water.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and so that's unreal and
I really
strange.
Did have, reading the opening passage where he talks about how they're out there on their own. I mean, I had experience kind of like that, where I was on a ship that wasn't that large and we were motoring from, you know, like one island to another. But in the middle of the night, there was a storm. And I went up on deck because I thought that'd be cool to see. And it was horrifying because every time there was a flash of lightning, you were just looking out into the abyss. There was no other ships or land around anywhere.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see any planes in the sky because of the cloud cover. And if this thing goes under, I mean, that's it. I'm not swimming to a pier.
No.
You know?
No.
Puts a fine point on the fact that we are very tiny in a large world, I guess.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and that's part of the kind of cosmic horror a little bit there, too. You know,
your
insignificance in the grand scheme of things. And heck, that's feeling insignificant on this planet, which is just a tiny speck in the greater cosmos.
I watched a whole thing on Mars exploration recently and like the mental rigors of having to do something like that.
Oh, going to Mars?
Going to Mars, yeah. Taking or any of these, you know, if we're ever going to try to colonize outer space.
Yeah.
The conditions, leaving home, the fact that nothing's designed for you, you know, the way that it will.
Yeah.
Well, we've adapted to this environment and this is what we know and we're relying on it.
Sanity.
It's yeah. just, it like, I start feeling insane just kind of thinking about it. I don't know how they're going to find the people to be able to do this.
Thinking about last week's story, think of how inhospitable the South Pole is. How hard it is to survive down there. And yet, that's Earth. That's cake compared to Mars.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can breathe there. You can't breathe on Mars. There's water there. There's no water on Mars.
Yet there are people who went out to the Antarctic just to say, I want to be the guy that gets to the South Pole, and I know that what's ahead of me is a year of absolute misery, and I'm going to do it anyway. And I think those are the characters that we're going to have to send out into deep space, but it's so antithetical to the way I am. You know, I like my security,
oh my God.
You know,
it's me just too. Like,
but I am attracted to those stories and maybe that's why they always do very well. You know, I mean, I read that book on Shackleton's journey cover to cover in a couple of days. I couldn't put it down. And these guys are eating dog pemmican and like, you know, dying one by one and just dying of boredom in a lot of cases because they'd be stuck somewhere with absolutely nothing to do and start going crazy.
Oh.
I couldn't put it down, but I guess it's like, I want to, you know, vicariously experience those things through some fictional characters or by real people who are telling their story, because never in a million years would I do that.
No way. Yeah. It's, you can experience it in a way through their stories, and then you can put that book away and go back to your nice warm couch.
Yeah.
And your television
breath.
And all your food and,
that's
and
right.
live a nice, happy life.
Be like, what? You want to drive downtown? Well, I bet you better bring some snacks. Because what if I'm caught a little hungry?
Oh boy.
Yeah, I'm not cut out for any of that stuff.
No,
but
neither am I, and I think that's fine. Most people aren't. That's why these people are exalted as heroes. They did this crazy stuff for us.
Speaking of people doing crazy stuff for us, I want to thank our reader, Wyatt S. Gray. See, I was looking for a transition there.
There you go. You found it.
I want to thank our reader, Wyatt S. Gray. He is always great. He always does a good job. And if you can see your way to do so, please go over to Audible and check out Postcards from the Void by the publishers Darkwater Syndicate. It's a collection of weird and horror short fiction that Wyatt reads. You can hear his beautiful voice in your ears doing entire stories, not just little selections from ours. There's also a collection called Shadows and Teeth by the same publishers that is excellent, that he narrates. Both of those are on Audible. Grab them, listen. Thank you so much, Wyatt, for reading for us once again.
I also want to thank our patrons.
I want to thank our patrons for being part of the team, and I got a list of them here. Let's read them off. I want to thank Adrian H.
I want to thank Andy Wells.
Alex Serrett, thanks so much.
I want to thank Todd W. Olson.
Profound thanks to Scott Malthouse.
Deep thanks to Ashley Cope.
I want to thank Mark Ahenda.
Resonating thank you to Jimmy Brune.
Thank you so much, Elliot Miller.
And last but not least, James Benelli. Thank you.
Next week, we're diving into a longer bit. It's called The Moon Pool. And this is by a very famous weird fiction author, A. Merritt, Abraham Merritt. That's what we're tackling next week. For now, that's all we got. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.